It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, are welfare programs helping or hurting business startups? We look at the link between government spending and entrepreneurship.
First, there's been some wild back and forth politicking this week over the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a major trade deal involving the United States and 11 other Pacific Rim nations. International negotiations have been in the works for 10 years and counting.
The deal heated up in the U.S. Senate this week with a tiff between President Obama and members of his own party, which led to a dramatic vote this week against fast-track trade approval authority.
The Senate has since reached an agreement to move that fast-track authority forward.
Manu Raju joins us now with the latest on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He's a senior congressional reporter at Politico. Manu, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here.
So what are the latest developments? This has been a rocky ride this week. What's happening with this right now?
The Senate has opened debate on this proposal. Now remember, this fast-track trade authority, what's also known as trade promotion authority, is an essential first step to enact the larger sweeping Trans-Pacific Partnership, as you mentioned, a 12-nation agreement that would affect 40% of the world's economy. The Senate, after back and forth that you mentioned, this was a debate between the Democratic Party in the Senate fighting with the White House, which badly wants this deal. The Democrats in the Senate are divided over this, and most of them do not want to move forward. But a handful of them joined with the United Senate Republican Conference today and agreed to begin the debate. So now we're going to move forward in the coming weeks. There are going to be debates over amendments and then try to move to final passage, presumably as soon as next week, before even more difficult consideration begins in the United States House, when Congress returns from its Memorial Day recess in June.
So this week, the Senate is not arguing about whether to approve the Trans-Pacific Agreement here. They're deciding how to approve it, right? So what would fast-track authority mean if it's ultimately passed?
Fast-track is very significant because what it essentially does is prevents Congress from amending the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So once this Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP as it's known, once that is agreed to by the 12 nations that are negotiating this, it would come to the Congress and it would move quickly through the House and the Senate. It would not be able to be amended. There would be an up or down vote in both chambers, and it could go to the president's desk. Why this is important for the people who are negotiating this, for the White House, they say they need to tell the other countries that Congress will not fiddle with this agreement, that whatever agreement they reach will be the agreement that the law will become the law of the land in the United States, which is why they need to get this fast-track authority done, which is why it's generated so much opposition, particularly from Democrats who want to kill the larger Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Talking to Manu Raju from Politico about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this big international trade negotiation. Negotiations still going on, generating a lot of political heat in the U.S. Congress as well. Now, Manu, let's get a little TPP 101. In broad strokes, what is the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Yeah, it's a 12-nation agreement that would really affect a wide swath of the United States economy and the world economy. About 40% of the world is dictated by this agreement. Essentially, it would affect everything from auto imports and exports to patents, intellectual property right agreements, to agricultural products, to textiles. This would affect trade within each of those individual countries. Now, what's difficult for us and the public to know exactly how it would affect the economy is that a lot of the negotiations are being kept under wraps. The reason being because the negotiating partners, particularly the United States, does not want to tip their hand on what the latest in negotiations are, because they believe it could actually undermine their talk. So that has made it harder for us to sort of assess the impacts of this agreement on the United States economy if it were to come to pass. And it's also, that's what's also spawned a lot of the opposition from people, particularly on the left, who are worried about the impact this could have on American jobs. Largely, the people who support this say that this will help American exports. This will be instrumental to the United States economy, and the folks who oppose it believe that it'll actually cost American jobs. That's really the dividing lines in the debate right now.
Well, a lot of the criticism out there in and out of Congress is about that essentially secrecy that you just mentioned. People are saying, how can we have fast-track authority and promise not to do amendments when we don't really know what's going to be in this thing that will get this up or down vote?
Yeah, and that's been a real challenge for the administration. The administration says that members of Congress have access to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They say that whatever the latest in the negotiations are, you can, if you're a member of Congress, you can go into a classified setting, you can review all the documents, you can get a good understanding for yourself. But the public does not see this. And also, when these members of Congress go into the secure room, they're not allowed to take notes. They cannot bring a staff member with them. They can't use their phone, take pictures of the text, and it's several hundred pages long. So it's obviously kind of very, very hard for a member, a very busy lawmaker, to really digest the impact of it. And they can't talk a lot of it because it is classified. So that is really what has prompted a lot of the concern. But the people who are supporting this say this is not unusual. When Congress, when anyone negotiates legislation, wants to pass a law, they usually do it in secret, whether the public likes it or not.
Now, the president has been making the case that, okay, maybe even if this isn't a perfect deal, if we don't do this deal, China is going to set the framework for what international trade looks like in the Pacific. Is that an argument that you think has traction with people in Congress?
I do think so, particularly a lot of these pro-trade Democrats, the folks who are sort of on the fence about whether or not to support this deal because they're worried about its impact on American jobs, but have been open to international trade agreements in the past. There is a very big concern. China is not a party to these negotiations, but yes, the fear is that if the United States does not engage in this part of the world, one of the fastest growing parts of the world, that China will exert its dominance. And so one of the reasons why the United States feels so strongly about engaging there, they do want to serve as a counterbalance to China and that part of the world. And if this falls apart, clearly the United States would not have that kind of influence. Certainly that's something you hear some members of Congress express concern about when there are talk about potentially killing this agreement.
Now, as I understand it, some of the Democratic critics of this Trans-Pacific Partnership in the Senate have been saying, in effect, okay, you want us to pass this thing? All right, but we want to bundle this other legislation with it, things to punish nations that tamper with their currency to help with their import-export balance and protections for labor or things like that. Are they going to be successful, do you think, in bundling at least some of that in?
Probably not. And part of the reason why is that there's concern from the administration that you add measures like that, it will scare off some of these negotiating partners. And they're already working actively behind the scenes to water down things about cracking down on human trafficking, for instance. That was added during the Senate Finance Committee consideration last month, and that would affect a Malaysia, which is one of the negotiating partners in this agreement. And already there's talk behind the scenes of watering down that anti-human trafficking measure because they're concerned about Malaysia walking away from this agreement. And there are other provisions like currency manipulation. There's an effort to crack down on countries that artificially suppress the value of their currency to boost their own home state exports. And the big target is Japan, for which allegedly has done this in the past. And Japan says if you add this to the TPA, the Trade Promotion Authority, they will walk away from this, which is a big reason why the administration is working actively to kill provisions like this. So I think Democrats will try to amend it, but they probably will not have the support from their own White House and, of course, from Republicans as well.
Manu, as we wrap up this negotiation, as I said up front, been going on for a decade now. Short term, what's the timeline for American approval of this fast track authority?
I would think that the next week is going to be a very critical week in the Senate. They're going to try to push this through and get it done in the Senate next week. It's going to be very hard to get it done because the Senate wants to go on a recess after next week for Memorial Day. There's also other things that are happening, like an expiring Patriot Act provisions that they need to get done. So if they get it done next week, then the House would have to get to it in June. So potentially at the earliest on the president's desk by the end of June, but I would not be surprised if it slips until July.
Manu, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Manu Raju. He's senior congressional reporter at Politico, looking at the latest on this week's congressional negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
America has long prided itself as a nation of entrepreneurs, and a lot of government policy has been geared toward creating a good environment for business startups.
Since the Reagan days, many politicians, especially on the Republican side, have made the case that smaller government helps stimulate such entrepreneurship.
But according to our next guest, new research shows that expanding the welfare state may actually boost startups. Walter Frick, associate editor at Harvard Business Review, joins us now. He's the author of the Atlantic article called Welfare Makes America More Entrepreneurial. Walter, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Ronald Reagan, it sounds like, used to argue that strong entrepreneurship was based on less intrusive government. What was the thinking behind that idea?
That's right. I think this idea has really become deep in our political debates, definitely since Reagan. And the idea is that if government just gets out of the way, entrepreneurs will do the rest. And you hear this a lot. Just let government get out of the way.
And in your article, you challenge that notion, and you say that actually when there is more to be found in the social safety net, that actually stimulates new and innovative businesses. Generally speaking, why is that the case as you see it?
That's right. So there's a growing body of research that suggests that actually if you can provide people with economic security, that ends up being the key to starting a business. When people have enough income, enough security, that they're able to feel like they can take a risk, that's actually what encourages entrepreneurship.
And risk is at the core of a lot of business startups, whether or not they feel that they can take a financial gamble with their health insurance, with their income, with children. So why would having a bigger social safety net help in this case?
So one example is health insurance for children. The Child Health Insurance Program basically extended publicly funded insurance to a large number of people, and what one of the studies that I write about found is that a good number of those folks, now that they didn't have to worry if they went off and started a business, that now their kid would not be able to have any health care, they were able to feel secure, their child would have health care no matter what. That made them comfortable taking that risk, taking that plunge into starting a new business. As a result, we got a lot more startups.
In terms of sheer numbers, how entrepreneurial is America right now?
That's actually a really interesting question. We hear a lot about Silicon Valley, and all startups are sort of on the tip of everyone's tongue, but America's actually become less entrepreneurial over time. So some of the reforms that I'm talking about, some of these welfare programs, they've helped increase entrepreneurship on the margin, but over the last 20 years or so, we've actually seen a decline.
And the thinking behind some of the first argument we began with, that limited government and maybe less social safety net stuff is better for entrepreneurship, this is that people may be complacent. They have their needs met. Maybe they have food stamps to rely on or health insurance in that case, and so they may not be motivated. Why isn't that what research is seeing play out?
Yeah, so the idea that people become dependent on government or demotivated, it's everywhere. It's talked about a lot, but it just hasn't really shown up in the data. And so food stamps are another program that I write about. There's a paper that looked at what happens when food stamps are extended to more people. And here again, it makes a lot of them feel secure enough where they can actually go off and start a business. I think what it speaks to is the fact that people it's not so much that they want to be dependent on government. They just want enough basic security so that they don't have to always worry about where their next paycheck is coming from. They don't have to feel that they're 100% on their dependent on their employer or on some program. They're willing to take a little bit of risk if you give them the chance.
Do we know how many people who start up businesses do then end up using programs like food stamps?
In some cases, they use the programs, but actually in a lot of cases, it's enough to know that those programs are there if they need them. So if you're aware that if everything fails, if your business goes under, which is very common when you start a new business, that if that happens, the government will step in and you'll be able to have some income, that's usually enough. And that matters a lot because it really reduces the amount that governments need to spend to get the benefit of some of this. Just sort of saying, this safety net is there if you need it is often enough to help people take some risk.
We're talking right now with Walter Frick, associate editor at Harvard Business Review, and he's the author of the Atlantic piece called Welfare Makes America More Entrepreneurial. And let's take another example here that there's been some research on, the Affordable Care Act. What have we found about the relationship between the Affordable Care Act and entrepreneurship?
So we don't know anything specifically about how that legislation has changed entrepreneurship yet, but there is strong research to suggest that what it's doing should help. And so there was a study in 2010 that looked at this idea that since so many of us get health insurance through our jobs, that becomes a real disincentive to go off and start a business. If I start something, I'm going to not only lose my salary, I'll also lose my health insurance. This is referred to as job lock. And job lock is the total opposite of what you want if you want to have an entrepreneurial economy. And what this study found is that actually the moment that people become eligible for Medicare, when they turn 65, they're way more likely to start businesses because now they can rest assured that they're going to be able to get health insurance and they're ready to take that plunge. So even though we don't know anything specifically about the Affordable Care Act, this other research really strongly suggests that if you do make health insurance possible to get not through an employer but through government, more people will take that as a sign that it's time to take that risk and to start a new business.
Now, the thing about a strong social safety net, these programs cost money, and often the programs are paid for with higher taxes. Wouldn't this in turn negatively affect startups and make people less likely to begin a business?
Yeah, it's a little trickier when it comes to the tax side of the equation. So the evidence is a bit mixed. It looks like overall there may be a very slight negative impact in terms of when taxes go up, you get somewhat fewer entrepreneurs. But there have been a lot of studies that look at this, and the effect is pretty small. So it may be slightly negative, but it also seems to be the case that you can raise taxes a reasonable amount without making too much of a dent in entrepreneurship. And ultimately, if you're looking at what will the impact be on startups, it's going to come down to what do you spend that money on. So if you raise taxes and you spend that money on things that help startups, you'll probably get more of them. If it's all the things that don't help startups, you might get just a little bit less on the margin.
Do we have a sense of which has a stronger result if you look at, say, a stronger social safety net versus lower capital gains tax? Which is what does it pay to focus on the most?
Well, I think it's not entirely clear which is the bigger factor. What my piece really wanted to argue is that we've just assumed that low taxes are the way to go, that a small government, bare-bones safety net, that these things are key to entrepreneurs. I think we really need to get rid of that assumption. It's going to be case by case, and different policies might work differently in different areas, different moments of time, but we've got to stop making this across-the-board assumption that bigger government is going to hurt entrepreneurs, because we know that in many cases it's actually the opposite.
What other studies have we seen coming forward? Has there been a convincing body of work, or is this something that's just starting to suggest itself?
Well, some parts of it, the health insurance piece, I think, is the farthest along. We've seen studies in that area for a while. But some of the other work that I mentioned in the piece around food stamps or some of these other areas, they're a little bit newer. And I think it's actually a pretty interesting area of research, and I would expect to see a lot more in this field over the next few years. And that's exciting. So I think we'll learn a little bit more than we do now. And I would expect we're actually going to see more and more examples where government actually supports startups, supports entrepreneurs.
Do you see this as being, right now at least, a partisan issue? And do you see that changing?
The politics of it are a little bit tricky. I think on the face of it, the challenge to this idea of low taxes and small government as crucial to entrepreneurs may feel threatening to conservatives. But actually, I think the Republican Party, conservatives generally, they're really bought in around the need to promote entrepreneurs, the need to promote innovation. So there may be some opportunity to engage the right in terms of using entrepreneurship as an argument for some of these programs that they may be traditionally less interested in.
And as we wrap up, how does entrepreneurship affect the economy at large? And is there broad agreement on that, at least?
Yeah, so this is the thing that I think Reagan really was right about. If you ask almost any economist, they're going to tell you that startups and entrepreneurs really are crucial to economic growth and to the broader prosperity of the economy. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But generally, small and new companies, they're very good at innovating, taking new ideas and bringing them to life, and they actually end up providing most of the new jobs over time in the economy. So whatever the recipe, I think everyone can at least agree that we need more startups, we need more entrepreneurs.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Walter Frick, associate editor at Harvard Business Review, and he's the author of a recent article in The Atlantic called Welfare Makes America More Entrepreneurial.
Wisconsin's Joint Finance Committee continued meetings about Governor Walker's budget proposals today.
The committee met to discuss and vote on several items in Governor Walker's budget proposal. The budget committee has been meeting for weeks and going through the governor's budget. Today, they were scheduled to vote on the governor's plan to cut property taxes in Wisconsin through a school tax credit.
We'll talk about this tax credit, what it can mean to Wisconsin's budget and economy. To kick it off, we have Sean Johnson back with us to talk about what happened at the Joint Finance Committee meeting today. He's the state government reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what happened at the JFC meeting today?
Well, we can talk about it in the present tense because they're still going today. Yep. They've got a lengthy agenda, as they will pretty much every day between now and when they finish work on this budget. You know, if you're at one of these things, they just go through dozens of motions and issue papers and take vote after vote and basically craft law on the fly. And in a few cases lately, Republicans have been going against the wishes of Governor Walker, at least, you know, on some small issues.
A lot of items being voted on today in general?
Yeah, so we had, there were a lot of changes to Milwaukee's child welfare program that were voted on. And I mean, they're getting as technical as who is running the program, whether a job that's going to be created to run these programs is a political appointment or not. They took votes on some funding for domestic abuse services. Agreed to fund those increase by $5 million. And right now they're talking about Wisconsin's W-2 program, which is the state's replacement for traditional welfare. One vote that they did take is they decided to go along with the governor and put a lifetime limit of 4 years on W-2. That would be a change in Wisconsin, which has always had a 5-year lifetime limit for that program.
Well, one item we've been keeping an eye on, a lot of controversy about this budget item, Wisconsin's long-term care system. What happened in joint finance with that today?
Yeah, no votes today, but what happened is you had the co-chairs of the finance committee talk to reporters before the meeting and basically say that the governor's proposals involving long-term care programs like IRIS and family care was not going to pass the finance committee. Now, we don't have a concrete proposal from Republicans that would replace that. We're going to find out in coming weeks what exactly they want to do, but this was really the most emotional issue that came up in the public hearings in the budget. Particularly, you had people who are participating in IRIS right now, people with disabilities who like the way that program lets them hire their own caretakers. In some cases, this can be a family member, and they get home-based services. They feel like that is it makes them feel good about their care to be in charge of their decisions and to be able to choose their caregivers is important to them. They're worried that the governor's budget, which turns that system over to a statewide system that's run by a for-profit insurer, could risk that. So essentially what the finance co-chair said today is we want to preserve that choice, but we do want to look at changing the way that long-term care programs are run. What that means, we'll find out later.
And then an issue we're going to focus on for the rest of this half hour, actually, the governor's plan to increase the school levy tax credit, in effect for many people, lowering their property tax bill.
Yeah, it's the state buying down their local property tax levy. So the state is spending state tax dollars to reduce your local property tax bill. This is, there are different mechanisms that the state can use to reduce property taxes. This is one of them. And what we might see this time around is that lawmakers might use that tax credit and the way that payments are made to it, the timing of those payments, they might kind of use some accounting maneuvers to use that money to go toward filling the cut to public schools instead. So in a school levy tax credit, sounds like it's going to classrooms. Not exactly. It's really about a property taxes. They might delay the payment for that and restructure it in a way that partially fills the hole for public schools. Or if they want to, they could just kind of go against the governor's wishes to increase that credit and use it all for schools. But I'm not sure they want to go that way.
And as I understand it, Joint Finance didn't get to a vote on this item today. Did they talk about it?
I tried to listen to Finance as long as I could before we started talking, and they had not talked about it yet. I wouldn't be surprised. You know, maybe they get to it today. Maybe, though, they will delay it and take it up along with the school's budget, which just got posted on the agenda for next week, because a lot of this stuff is all interrelated. And if at the end of the day they kind of have a number that they want to hit on how much money they want to spend on schools, there are a lot of ways to get there. Some can involve the issue papers they're taking up next week on the Department of Public Instruction and school aides. Some could involve what they do with property tax, you know, credits like this one.
No all-nighters on these, though, right?
Oh, yeah. They will have, I bet, they will have at least one all-nighter. That's the way that always goes. The last night that Finance works on the budget, they typically end it the next morning.
We'll get some sleep between now and then, Sean. Thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR State Government Reporter.
Now we're going to focus on the proposed property tax cut we just heard about. We're taking your calls on this. What do you think about Governor Walker's proposal to cut property taxes? Do you hope to see this cut go through, and how do you think this cut could affect the state's economy? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Dale Knapp joins us now, Research Director for the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Dale, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Well, we were just talking with Sean there about this school levy tax credit. Can you flesh that out a little more for us? How would the governor's plan change things if passed as he wrote it?
Well, the school levy credit is a property tax credit that taxpayers see on their December property tax bill. Right now, the total that's distributed each year is about $750 million. And the governor is proposing to increase that by about $105 million, so it would go up to a little over $850 million. So again, that would be seen on your December property tax bill coming up.
And when people use the phrase property tax relief, this is one of the ways that the state government could make that happen.
Yeah, this is one of the ways. There's several ways that the legislature and the governor can reduce property taxes. One is this way, directly via a credit. Another way would be to provide more aid to local governments with the expectation that that aid would replace property taxes. So, you know, one of the things they did, last year with, for example, technical colleges, is they gave them $400 million more in aid, and essentially required them to reduce their property tax levy by that same amount. So you could do it directly by providing more aid as well.
Now, with the school levy tax credit, is this something that every property owner gets a roughly equal taste of, or does it affect some communities more than others?
It affects communities differently. It depends on your school tax. So it's distributed based on your share of the overall school levy. So that's one of the arguments about this tax credit, whether or not that, you know, we should be doing the tax credit that way, which gets distributed one way, or whether that money should go into the school aid formula, which, again, that would be more aid to schools. It would reduce the property tax levy by that same amount. But because the aid formula distributes things differently, it would get distributed a little bit differently. So that's one of the big arguments is distribution. How do we want the tax relief distributed?
Now, in this budget, this isn't happening by itself. There's the talk of the legislature trying to make up some or all of the cuts to K-12 education that the governor has proposed. And they're maybe looking at this as a way to do it, playing with the timing of it, to leave more money in the budget to pay more for schools. Now, is this... We've heard people accused of using budget gimmicks over the years and kicking the can down the road. Is this an example of what people are talking about?
This is. So one of the things that has gone on historically is they've added to this credit in the past. If you go back to the 1990s, the credit was in the $400 million range. It's now almost $750 million. So we've added to this credit. And one of the things that they've done is that credit gets distributed to taxpayers in December, which is in the middle of the state's fiscal year, but they don't reimburse municipalities for it until the following July, which is in the next fiscal year. So what that does in terms of their budgeting is it saves them some money. And so what Governor Walker was proposing to do was pay for the credit on time, and so there wouldn't be any fiscal gimmicks here. But in order to restore the school funding, one of the things they've talked about is doing the same thing that they've done in the past and, push $105 million of it off into the next budget, essentially, which would free up, some money for this budget.
Let's bring on a caller to talk about this at 800-642-1234. We've got Cheryl on the line with us in Green Bay. Cheryl, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think about this?
Well, I don't 100% understand everything in there. All I know is I don't care that I get, my last amount of my tax that went down on my home was $10. For heaven's sake, keep the $10 in each house to help pay for our schools. Wisconsin has always been known as a great state for education, and if we want our students to be educated in a way that when they graduate they can go to college or they can get a job where they have a living wage, where they make enough to live on, we need to educate them all. We need to stop boosting educators. We need to stop taking money away from our schools.
I gotcha, Cheryl. Dale, first point she mentioned there is, hey, last time we got some kind of relief like this, it was $10. I'd rather the money go to the schools, Cheryl is saying. Are we talking about big amounts showing up on our property tax bills with an increase in this particular tax credit, Dale?
We are not. If you look at the total sounds big. It's $106 million each year over the next 2 years. And that sounds like a big amount, but when you spread that over the entire state, for the average person, if they have a $150,000 house, it's about $3. $200,000 house, it'd be about $450. So, in terms of the individual property taxpayer, it's going to be a small amount.
Now, as Cheryl says, this is complicated, but with this credit, it's not exactly as if we're saying, okay, we're taking this money out of school funding and giving it back to property taxpayers. It's a little less direct than that, right?
It is. And this is one of the things that has caused, one of the many things that has caused school funding to really become confusing over the years. If you go back to 1997, when the state made their two-thirds commitment to school funding, one of the things that they counted in terms of state funding of schools was this school levy credit, which never went to schools. It simply went to property taxpayers. And so it's allowed really the state to sort of count this as school funding. And so when this has come up in the past in terms of raising the credit, we've always had the debate of, should that money go into the credit where it's still counted as state funding for schools for some reason, or should we put it to the school aid formula, which would go to schools? And so, we've had this, we have this debate really every time this issue comes up, which has been, three or four times over the past 15 years.
We're talking to Dale Knapp from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance about Governor Walker's proposed tax credits, property tax credits. Complicated. We're sorting things out here. That's in this current budget debate.
And we're taking your calls on this. Do you think this property tax cut is a good idea? And how do you think it could impact Wisconsin's economy? Call in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the discussion, get to your calls in a minute after a look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst.
We're continuing our conversation now with Dale Knapp, Research Director for the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, about Governor Walker's proposed tax credit for homeowners.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the idea or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right back to a caller. We've got Mary on the line in Lake Geneva. Mary, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I'm a teacher, and this will be the fifth year in a row that I have taken a cut in pay due to either higher insurance or just a pay cut because of our financial situation for our district. And so I think the money that is designated for education should stay in education.
Mary, thanks for the call. Well, that's a conceptual question there in a way, Dale. Is this money that was originally intended for education?
This is part of you know, the state budget, and it's simply that the state has a certain amount of money that it can spend based on tax revenues. And so the governor and the legislature, you know, this money, you know, they can decide, you know, any new tax revenue is not earmarked for, you know, certain items. So they could have spent it on anything. This could go for additional school funding. This could go toward Medicaid. This could go for other programs. The governor had decided, you know, because his focus has been on property tax relief, you know, he decided that he wanted to spend this amount of money on the credit. And so, again, it can be, you know, it could be moved around and you know, put into school aids or, you know, theoretically it could be moved into other places.
Dale, as we wrap up, this is, as you mentioned, not a huge amount for any individual taxpayer, this increase in credit. Is the argument, you know, a little bit here in property tax, a little bit over here in another kind of tax, and it really could make a difference, more money in people's pockets, a boost to the economy?
Well, the answer to that question is no, and there's not really going to be an economic effect, and there's two reasons for that. One, like you said, it's very small. It's less than 0.1% of Wisconsin's $300 billion economy. So it's very, very small amount. But second is, when you think about it, if we do this, yes, it's a small amount in everybody's pocket, and they spend that. But suppose that we put it into, you know, additional school money. So what the schools end up spending that, and maybe they spend it on raises. So, you know, a smaller group would get additional money and would spend that. Or, you know, maybe they spend it on another program. So, you know, it's state spending one way or another.
Gotcha. Dale, we'll leave it there. That was Dale Knapp, Research Director for the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Thanks to him. We also heard from WPR's reporter Sean Johnson.